Coming up on this episode of Greyhound Nation, John interviews Greyhound adoption author and animal welfare advocate, Cynthia Branigan. She shares her passion for greyhounds and news about her upcoming book. Keep listening. The Nation is next. This is Greyhound Nation, episode 23, recorded August 17th, 2021. Greyhound adoption author Cynthia Branigan. Greyhound Nation is a podcast for greyhound enthusiasts produced by Greyhound Enthusiasts. To learn more about our show and its hosts, visit our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. Welcome to another episode of the Greyhound Nation podcast. I'm Michael Burns. Now, here's your host, John Parker.
Welcome back, everybody. We have a guest on this show that I knew when we started the podcast that I'd want to have at some point. Greyhound, a very early Greyhound author of Greyhound Adoption, Cynthia Branigan. Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you.
We're going to start a little bit. Cynthia's got a new book out called The Last Diving Horse in America. And as I've mentioned before, lots of Greyhound lovers are also horse lovers. And we're going to talk a little bit in the second half of the show about the new book and how Cynthia came to write it and all about it. I've read it. It's a great book. Everybody, I think, will enjoy it. Cynthia, tell us a little bit about how you got started in just the general animal welfare movement.
Certainly, my interest in animals dates to childhood, early childhood, perhaps because I was an only child. I'm not sure, but we always had cats. My father wouldn't let me have a dog. That's what I really wanted. And he said, you can have as many dogs as you want when you grow up, but they held it to cats. So I love the cats and still do. But it progressed from there to a more intense interest when I was at college and had an experience in the woods with a trapped raccoon. And actually, it was only the paw of the raccoon, the animal being so desperate to get away that he gnawed off his own leg. And it really affected me profoundly. And I just thought there has to be some way to help other animals like that. And I eventually met author Cleveland Amory. At the time, he was considered the founding father of the modern animal protection movement. And he saw something in me, I guess is the best way to put it, and allowed me to volunteer, which is something, it's not that easy to come by. I tried to volunteer at the Philadelphia Zoo, and because I was neither a scientist nor a veterinarian, they wanted nothing to do with me. Okay, so, but Cleveland allowed me to volunteer, and after 3 years took me on as a staff member. But at that point, I still wasn't sure what I had to contribute other than an interest. And, you know, my heart went out to animals, but I'm looking back, I can see I just don't have the personality to be, you know, an activist and someone to be picketing and shouting. I mean, that's just not my thing. And in fact, I don't even think that works. So when things came to a head and turned the course of my life was when I found out about the last steel pier diving horse who was up for auction. And one had already been at auction and was sold to a slaughterhouse. And I just vowed to myself, this isn't going to happen to this one. And I spoke to Cleveland and he was on board with it. Gave me a blank check, if you can imagine, and sent me down into the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. And I bought the horse. And then from that point, I mean, obviously I'm skipping over a lot, but from that point, I saw that my contribution to the welfare of animals really has to do with finding homes for them and finding the right homes for them, not just any home.
And there was a crossroads, so to speak, from reading the book between Gamal, the diving horse, and your first greyhound. Tell us how you got that first greyhound and how that intersection happened yes. between the horse and the greyhound.
Yes, I would say that was a pivotal moment for my first greyhound, who was named King. His racing name was Low Key 2, T-W-O. And he had been in several homes. There wasn't really a local adoption group around here, but there was a woman who for a time had done adoptions. And King came back several times. And I happened to run into her at a street fair. And we started talking. And I think she saw me as a soft touch and told me about this poor dog, a greyhound who was kept in the basement because the man's new wife didn't want dogs in the house. So he lived in the basement, I think, for a year. And eventually the dog stopped eating. I mean, who wouldn't? And so he called her and she said, gee, I'm not really doing adoptions anymore, but I'll see what I can do. And I was the one. So I went down and adopted him. But he was really a sad sack. He almost didn't have the will to live at that point. He was 10 years old. He was very depressed. The only good thing I can say is at the time I had 6 cats and he had absolutely no interest in the cat. So I thought, all right, even if I just continue to shelter and feed him until he dies, that's better than being taken to the pound, you know? So, of course, I had Gamal at the time, and I used to visit him often at the farm. And my previous dog had just died. He was a border collie named Stockbridge. So I used to take Stockbridge with me. So, of course, I took King with me. And in the beginning, King had no interest in that either. But then after a couple of weeks, I noticed he stood up in the car as we were getting closer to the farm, and then it'd start to whimper. And I could tell the tone wasn't a fearful whimper. It was kind of excited. And the fact that he was kind of excited was very exciting to me. So I used to take him into a paddock, which, thank God, was fenced on the inside with wire. And Gamal was on the other side. And, you know, it was kind of a tenuous thing at first. They sniffed each other through the fence. Gamal, you know, then kept looking at my car. But where's Stockbridge? Well, Stockbridge was nowhere, but King was there. So Gamal started to gallop. And King immediately said, I know about this. I can run. And they started running up and down the fence till they were both winded. And that became the turning point in King's life. He became my companion, my pet. And it was because of the horse.
So he had kind of an awakening, you might say, from meeting the horse. That kind yes. of brought him out of his depression.
Oh, definitely it did. And the horse just inherently knew, well, here's something I can do. Can you do it too? The dog said yes. And they were off to the races.
That had to be a great feeling. Two former athletes, now retired, they find joy in running again.
Yeah. That was the language they spoke. And I didn't speak that language, you know, but at least I was able to take King somewhere where somebody did. And that somebody was the horse.
And did that become a regular thing whenever you went to the farm where Gamal was kept, that King would go with you and they would play together and so forth?
Every time, yes.
Oh, that's great. What did that, what effect did that have in your interest in greyhounds?
Well, I already knew at the beginning when I first adopted King, and that was in April of 1987. I already knew that the fate of many of the retired dogs was not what I wanted for them. And so I think it was about 6 months after, maybe less, after I adopted King, a greyhound was turned into the local SPCA. And there was a local man who apparently bought a female and then bred her. They were racing dogs. I think bought it from somebody in Connecticut, as I recall, and then was selling the pups. So they weren't dogs who had ever raced, but they were purebred greyhounds. But somebody adopted one or bought one, I guess, didn't work out. They took it to the local SPCA. The SPCA called me because they knew I had a greyhound, and they asked if I could find him a home. So I brought him home and found a home for him the next day, which was kind of remarkable because there wasn't even an internet, but I think a lot of phone calls were involved. And then I thought, gee, if there's this one, what about the other ones? And the woman who put me in touch with King, she wasn't doing it anymore, but she had told me that for the brief period that she had been placing dogs, there were lots and lots of them in New England, and they needed homes. So I thought, well, I have some experience with placing animals. So, you know, it's the old one thing led to another story.
Now, were you doing it initially, like that second greyhound from the SPCA, on an individual basis, or did you at some point decide, well, let's expand this and form a group? In other words, did you know about adoption, greyhound adoption groups at the time?
No, I didn't. I knew there were some at different tracks in New England, but I wasn't affiliated with any. I think it's back to the only child thing again, you know, where I kind of do things on my own. So at a certain point, I thought I should incorporate, and then I would be able to raise money. I have to say that didn't work out very well, but, you know, hope springs eternal. And then all of a sudden, one day I had a call from the woman who ran the, a woman named Chris, who ran the adoption kennel up in Seabrook, New Hampshire. And somehow she heard that I had just started a group, and she wanted to know if I'd start taking in dogs, and dogs plural. And, you know, I didn't have a kennel. I was a volunteer, as I still am. And I think I had one person helping me at that point. But somehow, you know, the ball was rolling, and I have a hard time saying no to animals. And here we are. We've placed over 5,500 at this point.
And so when did you actually form the group, and how did you come to pick its name? We should mention what that name is, by the way.
Yes, then yes, that's good. The name is Make Peace with Animals, and it was formed in 1988. And I think the motto of the organization is important. It's make peace with yourself, make peace with each other, and make peace with animals. And it has always been important to me, kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, that I'm not a rabble rouser kind of a person. And I think that when you get into that mindset that we're right and they're wrong, and you can't talk to people who ostensibly are on the other side, you've already lost the battle. Even if you win, let's say, just using this as an example off the top of my head, with the legislation that was passed in Florida and all the tracks are now closed, it's illegal. Well, okay, so you've accomplished that goal, but what about the people left behind? And not just the trainers, but also, you know, the people who supply the food and people who clean up. I mean, all of that. They're not happy people, nor should they be. And so the, let's say the anti-racing people achieved their goal, but they left behind enemies. So in my opinion, that's not a clean victory. My approach has always been, isn't there a way that we can work something out? For, I think it was 5 years, I wrote a column for the Greyhound Review, which, as you know, is the, well, at the time, it was the monthly magazine of the National Greyhound Association, and it was called From the Home Front. And my goal there was trying to get the racing people to see what we go through on this side, the challenges and the joys and everything in between. And, you know, I wrote articles on such things as when one of my dogs died, or kennel management, or the reasons people give when they return a dog, and how you can help us by telling us more about the dogs before we get them in order for us to make better matches, that sort of thing. So I did that for 5 years, and I did it because trying to build a bridge.
Well, I think you succeeded in a lot of ways. You know, when I got started in greyhound adoption a little bit after you did in 1994, and that was just the beginning of the internet, you know, the old Greyhound L listserv, and there was a few racing people on there, and the hostility was palpable, you know, between adoption people and racing people for the most part. But as people like you began to write those columns and kind of form that bridge between the racing community and the adoption community, they really became a partnership over the years, and the hostility, for the most part, ceased. There was still some suspicion in some corners here and there, but you know, I think and that's the shame of it, as you were pointing out with the Florida vote. We had just, you know, not too long ago formed this partnership, just over that it had evolved over the years from adversity and hostility to working together. And now, you know, it's essentially gone in terms of a large number of greyhounds that can be rehomed and can live out their lives with families. And you know, it's such a shame that if bridges could have just been built a little better, as you did, then maybe we wouldn't be where we are.
Maybe. And of course, money talks, and with the anti-racing side having millions at their disposal,
yes,
it's pretty hard to fight that. And yeah, there are so many well-meaning people out there who went along with it. People who I know personally, and I know to be intelligent, and they just, you know, it's the old hook, line, and sinker. They fell from the stories. And I think it's very hard to come back from that. But I think it should have started a long time ago, like 30 plus years ago.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you wonder, what if there had been social media back then? Mm-hmm. And people could, you know, social media certainly has its problems. But it also is a great form of communication and getting to know one another. And I just wonder if we'd had social media like we have it today back then, it might have been a little easier to have built those bridges and reach those understandings between, you know, two seemingly opposed groups.
I think it would have. But
so let's return to happier days for a second and talk a little bit about how your group grew and who you came to, which tracks and adoption people you came to work with, and what you did to grow the group, so to speak.
Well, it was sort of an organic process. As I said, the first track to contact me was Seabrook. And then I think after that, I was contacted by Belmont, which was in, I think it was called Lakes Region Greyhound track, but it was in Belmont, New Hampshire. And that was a seasonal track. And that was kind of a nightmare because they used to close around Columbus Day. And, you know, there were all kinds of stories about what happened to the dogs when they closed down the track. And I'll be honest, some of those stories were true. Not all, but some of those stories were true. But we were deluged with dogs from Belmont. And then eventually, let's see, Bridgeport, Connecticut, I'm not sure when they opened. We were at it for quite a while when Bridgeport opened, maybe 94 or 5, something like that. And Plainfield, Connecticut. I mean, all of them. Wonderland in Raynham. Oh, and Hinsdale in New Hampshire, lest we forget. you know, it just went from there. And then from time to time, we would get dogs from Florida. But primarily, what was the place in Rhode Island?
Lincoln.
Lincoln, yes. Yeah. Thank you, Lincoln. But we would get dogs from Florida from time to time. But honestly, it didn't make much sense to bring them up from Florida when the dogs would have an easier time coming down from New England.
Now, during this time, were you transitioning almost entirely to greyhound adoption, or were you still working with the Fund for Animals and doing the burrow and horse rehoming?
No, I had finished that in 1987. And I think I was kind of in between things. I wanted to write, not necessarily about greyhounds or diving horses or anything, but I wanted to write. And I think I had about 2 weeks, and then I got the phone call from the local SPCA. We have a greyhound here, and understand you have 2 weeks. Not and much was accomplished in 2 weeks.
And then you still have the group. Make Peace with Animals is still a going concern, and you're still rehoming greyhounds.
Yes. We have, I mean, of course, there are so far fewer dogs than there used to be. We used to take dogs every single weekend. And I remember one load in particular came during Hurricane Floyd, and the dogs were coming down from Belmont, New Hampshire, and they were supposed to get there in daylight. Well, they wound up coming at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and the wind was lashing at the windows and, you know, the rain and everything else. And what are you going to do with, I think it was 18 or 20 dogs in the middle of the night? So we scrambled. I had a little outbuilding that could hold 4 dogs, and we set up tents in the back, pup tents.
Literally.
And set them up within a fenced yard. And then we regrouped the next morning and started processing the dogs. But I stopped working for the fund. The Borough Project had ended at that point, and I didn't really want to go back to the same sorts of things I had been doing for the fund. So we mutually agreed that I was going to try something else.
And the group has always operated without an adoption kennel, correct? You
work
through entirely through foster homes.
Through foster homes. I mean, I do feel, I mean, maybe we could have taken even more dogs, but I think 5,500 isn't a bad showing.
Boy, I'd say.
I like the idea of getting to know the dogs better, having the foster people tell me, what their likes and dislikes are. I mean, the goal is always to make a good match.
Have you ever stopped and counted how many greyhounds you personally fostered throughout those years? Or I want to make a wild stab at it?
No, not sure I want to know. Not sure my husband wants to know. You know, we just kind of keep moving forward. And we do keep a fair number of the dogs ourselves, I mean, permanently, because the ones we have, I think I mentioned this to you a few days ago, are ones that I hate to use the word unadoptable, because I'm not sure any animal is unadoptable, but let's say they've been on the market forever. And, you know, no matter how much we talk about the animal's good points, no one has come forward to adopt. So, you know, they seem to be happy here. We know what we're doing. We know how to handle them. So a fair number of them stay.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you wrote the first, how-to manual on adopting a racing greyhound. It tell us a little bit about what put the germ of that idea in your head and why you decided to do it.
I would say the genesis of that was ignorance, because I realized that here I had this dog, a racing greyhound, but it became obvious to me very quickly that they weren't like other dogs. Now, I had only had one other dog before the greyhound. That was the border collie I mentioned, named Stockbridge, which is the name of the town where I found him. But I certainly have had experiences with dogs throughout my life and knew a lot of people who had dogs, but the greyhound was different. They looked different. They acted different. Then there were those things that you couldn't do with. You can never let them run loose. You can't use certain pesticides or insecticides on them. Then there was the whole thing about anesthesia, and they're sensitive to this and that. And I thought, if I don't know it, nobody else knows it either. And it's a service to the dogs to write this twofold. One is to protect the dogs, and the other is to encourage people to adopt them. Because, as I said, at the time, thousands upon thousands upon thousands needed homes.
And how did you go about actually writing it? In other words, did you write it and then shop it to publishers, or did you get a publishing commitment first and then write it?
No, I wrote it first. That's taking a big chance. It had to be done. I felt at the time that even if it turns out that I have to Xerox the damn thing, you know, and give it out to people, it has to be done. But I knew it would have better distribution if it was picked up by a publishing house. And so I sent out a query letter and I got a bite.
How long did it take you to write it?
That would have been maybe around 6 to 8 months, something like that.
Did you write every day?
Oh, yes. Yes, I write it. I write and then I rewrite. Yeah. And then I rewrite, write, and like that. But I had worked on newspapers, and it kind of came natural to me to how to lay it out, the introduction, the body, and the conclusion. You know, that I'm a writer, so I knew how to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I you know, it helped innumerable people. When I adopted my first Greyhound in 94, what I got was a 2-page sheet that just barely hit the high points. You know, like you said, no off lead in an unfenced area, watch out for anesthesia sensitivity. I mean, just the fundamental basics and not much of that. And so, the first thing I did was go out and, you know, go to my local Barnes and Noble and see if there were any books on it. And there's Cynthia Branigan's book, and I bought it, and it was a big, big help. And I'm sure that you've heard this over and over again, that, you know, it was such a much needed resource as Greyhound adoption was taking off,
It was taking off at that point. And I also made a point of listing all adoption groups in the back of that book, because I didn't want this to be my show. I wasn't looking to take over the world of Greyhound adoption. It was the farthest thing from my mind. But I thought if somebody did pick the book up in a Barnes and Noble somewhere, they could look and say, oh, look, there's one only, you know, half an hour from here. And they would get in touch with them. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And so you got a bite on your first attempt to get a publisher interested.
Yes.
That's great.
That was kind of amazing. And I had no way of knowing this, but the publisher was Irish, and he had greyhounds in Ireland growing up.
A little hook always helps, doesn't it?
It was amazing. I was speechless, but that got him interested. When you're an unpublished writer, meaning you haven't published a book, you send out these query letters, but they tend to wind up in what's called the slush pile. And then some assistant, you know, is assigned the job of, okay, go through them and see if you find something that is marginally interesting. And usually they're not. But in this case, because it had the word greyhound in the title, somehow the publisher himself happened to see it and said, oh, this looks interesting. It was a stroke of luck.
It really was. And you know, back in those days, it wasn't nearly as easy to self-publish as it is now. I mean, that would have been, if you'd not gotten an interested publisher, like you said, about the only thing you could have done was a Xeroxed it and you know, see if other groups would want to buy it at your cost or whatever. So that was a great stroke of luck. It was a well-written book. I mean, how would you, especially if you were a niche publisher that published animal-related, dog-related books particularly, you couldn't pass that one up.
I guess, yes.
Now, you've written, there's been 3 editions of it. Is that correct?
Yes.
How did those change from one to the other?
Updated information. They're all are bigger than the previous edition, longer, more detailed. Yeah. And I learned more, so I had to put it in.
Is there going to be a 4th edition?
I don't think so. No, because Greyhound adoptions, I'm sorry to say, are on the decline. So there wouldn't be a market for it now. But at the time, there really was a market. I didn't even know how big the market was. I just knew dogs needed homes. Let's do it right.
Do you still get reports from time to time about how many copies have sold?
I do. I know that it's this is an incredible number, but it's over 100,000 copies.
That's amazing.
So, but just as at the beginning, there weren't very many adoption groups. Mine was the only book for almost 10 years until another one came on, then another and another. And of course, that waters things down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mine is still the only one written by someone who runs an adoption group. And I really think that makes a difference because you're on the inside. You know why people return dogs, how to make the right matches, what to look for, what about the application process when people have unrealistic expectations. That's
yes.
Sort of thing. And
yeah.
You don't know that if you're writing it as someone maybe who adopted a couple of greyhounds yourself. You can't know it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, it's very fortunate, I think, and you were perceptive about it. You can read the book and it has no agenda. You know, there's no, it's just the facts, ma'am, kind of book. And there's no, these poor, pitiful greyhounds, they're victims and they need to be treated with kid gloves and so forth. It's just a very much factual account of what to do with a racing greyhound when you've adopted it and that it's a dog like any other.
Yes. I didn't have an agenda other than encouraging people to adopt, but only the right people.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, after you wrote the book and it came out and everybody in the greyhound adoption community knew who Cynthia Branigan was, you became in some demand, as I recall, as a speaker. You were kind of a greyhound celebrity, you might say. That kind of took off. Did you begin to get a number of requests to come and speak?
I did by pretty much every adoption group except not so much the anti-racing community. Even though I never even brought the subject up, I never did, but I was shunned.
How did you decide how many speaking engagements a year or a month you would accept?
Well, first of all, I was very busy finding homes for dogs, so that figured in. And I didn't charge. You may recall that when I came
yes.
to Atlanta.
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't charge, so of course that shot me right to the top. My price was right. But, you know, I could only afford to do not even one a month. I couldn't afford to do it. But I didn't feel right charging adoption groups because, again, I knew from my side of things how hard it is to the vet bills, for one thing, how hard it is to pay the vet bills for dogs. And if they were paying me, then maybe they wouldn't be able to pay a vet bill.
Yeah, so. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you were a very engaging speaker. You spoke from the heart, seemingly without notes. You were funny. You injected some good humor into your talks, great stories that made everybody laugh. Had you had any speaking experience? Or did it just come natural?
I didn't have any speaking experience. And I remember you said I was the comedian of greyhound adoptions. Do you remember saying that?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I never thought of myself that way. No, I mean, mostly everything here is ignorance, dumb luck, you know, just fly by the seat of my pants.
Well, you were a draw, I can tell you, because, you know, if one of these regional meetings or a GPA national conference, if Cynthia Branding was speaking, It got him more registrations because people, you were one of the few that could really talk on the subject. The racing folks were usually too busy to come and speak. Gary Guccione at the NGA came and he was a good speaker as well.
Yes.
And so if the two of you were coming to speak at an event, that was a draw. And so, you know, it's to your credit that you were able to kind of transition from being a writer into being an engaging speaker as mm-hmm. well. And I know a lot of people enjoyed hearing you over the years.
Thanks.
Do you still accept speaking engagements from time to time?
I'm not sure I've been asked recently, to be completely honest. But, oh, yes, I certainly would. I have some trouble traveling because right now, at least, a lot of our dogs are elderly. And so even though I have a pet sitter who can come and she stays with the, you know, it's she doesn't come and feed them and then leave. She stays with them. But when they're really old, the way some of ours are, you know, the slightest change in schedule would throw them off. And I'm certainly not going to jeopardize my animals for a speaking engagement.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, you wrote a second book, Reign of the Greyhound. What led to your writing that one?
That was based on a love of history. And when I was writing Adopting the Racing Greyhound, I think it's a full chapter. I haven't read the book recently, but one of the chapters was a very brief. Yeah, I think that's what it was called, A Brief History of the Breed. And it was very brief. But I remember starting off maybe the way I did in grade school by looking in the encyclopedia. And then I, you know, kind of went on from there. But in every book I read about greyhounds, they were always referred to as the oldest breed of dogs. Now, it wasn't exactly the greyhound. It was the greyhound family. And you certainly know plenty about that. You know, the Afghans and Salukis and Borzoi and all of that. The greyhound family is the oldest of the purebred dogs. That's another delineation.
Yes.
So, you know, the adoption book was about adoption, but I wanted people to appreciate the yet another way in which these dogs are different, but I could only devote one chapter to it. So then I decided to revisit and go back and see how much more I could learn about them. And that became The Reign of the Greyhound.
How long did it take you to write that one?
Well, that took longer. That was a lot of digging and research and buying, you know, antiquarian books and that sort of things. Again, before the internet. So there was a man named Doggy something. I forget what his last name was, but he was Welsh, Doggy Hubbard. And he had a antiquarian dog bookstore in Wales. And, you know, then he would send me, you know, remember airline airmail paper?
Yes, the blue paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he'd handwritten, send me a list of the books he had. I mean, it took forever just going back and forth with this airline paper. But, you know, I bought a bunch of books from him, went to the AKC, Dog Library in New York, and the Dog Museum in St. Louis. Well, at the time it was in New York, then it was in St. Louis. I think it might be back in New York. I'm not sure where that dog museum is. But, you know, little by little, I was able to piece together the history of the breed. And the artwork, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, once I got started with that, it was just, where do you stop? But I did research at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and there's a place called Art Resource in Manhattan. And when I went in, you know, they asked, well, what are you looking for? And they have files on every subject. I said, looking for greyhound art. And, you know, they kind of cocked their head. And I said, you know, they're in this, this, and this. So they really couldn't help me, but they just gave me giant stacks of reproductions. And then I would go through them. And by the time I was done, they now have a file of greyhound art. So if somebody in the future goes in looking, it's all there.
That's amazing.
That was a pretty good accomplishment.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you imagine how much easier it would have been now to write that book with the advent of the internet and Google and so forth?
But it was good training.
Yeah, absolutely.
It really was good training. So.
And how did you write that one the same way that you did Adopting the Racing Greyhound, where you wrote it first and then shopped it to publishers, or did you do it the other way around on that occasion?
Just trying to remember. It was a long time ago. Well, it was the same publisher, and I had pitched the idea to him, and then he was interested. And I said, well, as it happens, I already wrote it and gave it to him. And then there was some back and forth with the editor, too much of this, not enough of that, that sort of thing.
And did you go to Abilene as part of your research?
Yes, I went. Yes, that was a great experience, to the Hall of Fame down in the basement. Have you been down there?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, my God. The fluorescent lights. And I don't think there was air conditioning. It was just cooled by the Kansas earth. That and the fluorescent lights and those files. I don't know what they were like when you were there, but when I was there, I mean, they were not organized.
We'll put it that way. Yeah. So I just did it. Was a little better organized when I was there. You wouldn't know it from it's well very well organized upstairs in the mm-hmm. in the hall itself, but you do go downstairs and you could tell that they haven't had quite the attention to detail and having things where you could find them quite as easily. Yes, did you get easy access? Were they happy to have you and no suspicion or anything like that?
No, but I figured since I was out there, I'd say that would have been around 94 or 5, something like that. The book came out in 97, so somewhere around there. But I thought, gee, I'm here. I should call that man who's the head of the organization, Gary Guccione, and he said, oh, sure, come on over. And, wow. I mean, I thought it was a big deal meeting him, honestly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah. Gary was another Greyhound celebrity in the day.
Yes, I miss him.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to be seeing him in a few weeks when I go out to the Heart of America Greyhound Gathering. Michael's going with me. Gary and I have stayed in touch over the years. He still sends me jokes over email and things like that. So it's been a great relationship. We'll have to get the two of you together sometime.
I would like that. We do communicate via email occasionally. He always sends a Christmas card. And, but, as far as getting together, I don't know.
Yeah.
When the twain shall meet.
Yeah, exactly.
But hopefully sometime soon.
Well, I'll tell you a little personal story about me. When I read Reign of the Greyhound, I had begun to get interested in Greyhound history. And then, I was really captivated by the coursing part of the history of the Greyhound. And I said, I've got to go to see this Waterloo Cup in England. Mm. And so 98 was the first time I went. I went with a small group of American friends. And we were just totally taken in by it. It was just everything about it was wonderful. The people were nice. The countryside was beautiful. The Greyhounds were just, outstanding. And it began a long time relationship that I've had now with a number of Greyhound folks in England. Sadly, coursing was banned in England in 2005. And that ended a whole tradition. But you were standing there when you went on the same fields where they had run 100 or 150 years ago, where Fullerton had run, where Master McGrath had run. And it just kind of took your breath away to realize that you were there and all this Greyhound history just kind of came down on top of you and you couldn't believe you had the good fortune to be there. I'm just glad I saw it before it was over. That was one. So thank you. This is a good opportunity to thank you for writing that book and inspiring me to take a trip to England to see coursing.
Thank you. But so do they have artificial lure coursing?
No. Well, there is lure coursing in England on an amateur basis, but the coursing people never seem to really want to take that up. Lure coursing is done. It's a very popular whippet sport, for example. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of whippet lure coursing, but the Greyhound people by and large they were traditionalists, I suppose, and if they couldn't chase the real thing, they weren't really that interested in lure coursing, which was always a puzzlement to me because I think that would have been a good successor to the sport. There was some concern that if they were able to demonstrate that the dogs could chase a lure, that would give the anti-coursing people, more ammunition to say, well, you should just be chasing plastic bags instead of hares. And so they didn't. They always hoped that coursing would be, the ban would be reversed. It doesn't look like that's ever going to happen now. And so they just never took it up, which I think is kind of a shame that they didn't. But in any event, that was a great segue for me to get over there and make some lifelong friends and have great memories of that part of the breed. So thanks again for writing that book. How many has it sold?
I'd say maybe 35,000, 40,000, uh-huh. something like yeah. that. Not yeah. nearly what the adoption book has sold.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's kind of transition over to your latest book, The Last Diving Horse in America. Those are also four-legged athletes. Tell us how you came to write that book.
Well, as the Greyhound adoption work started to taper off a bit, I haven't had much time in my life to do anything except the Greyhounds, but I did have some time to kind of reflect on where my life had been. And, you know, when I would tell people a story here or there, no one could believe it. And I started to realize that, maybe I've led kind of an unusual life, and I've certainly met some unusual animals. And my connection to that horse, Gamal, was so strong that I'll even get choked up talking about it now. And he died in 1989. But the idea that he would just have died and that would have been the end of it didn't sit right with me, because someday I'll die. And then what? Then he'll be gone forever. And it wasn't right. And I felt that describing our relationship was important for people to read about and think about, because, you know, they might think about animals in a different way, in a better way, and give them more credit than they currently get. So as I think I started talking at the beginning of this, I was working for the Fund for Animals. Cleveland Amory had put me in charge. I'm using that phrase loosely, but he put me in charge of the organization while he and his assistant took off on the QE2. He used to go on lectures, and they would pay him, and he would, you know, regale them with stories. And also, the people on board ship tended to be well-heeled, as my father would say. And then he would get them to donate to the Fund for Animals. So it was a match made in heaven. But he and his assistant both couldn't leave the main office at the same time. And as I said in the book, I don't know why he chose me. Was no one else willing or able to do it? I don't know, but he did. And I took care of things several times. And again, not making major decisions or anything of the sort, but just holding down the fort. And one day a phone call came in from a woman. I don't know if you remember Ma and Pa Kettle. I'm dating myself with
them. Yes, yes, I'm dating myself. I remember them.
But Marjorie Maines, or Maine, was the Ma Kettle. And she had that kind of voice, you know, and she called up and said, you know, I want to speak to Cleveland. And I said, I'm sorry. She said it was an emergency. I said, well, he won't be back for a couple of weeks. Can I get your name and number? I'll have him call you. And she took me for the idiot that perhaps I was. And she said, I said it was an emergency. Who the hell is in charge there? And here I am. So then she started telling me that the emergency was that the last Atlantic City steel pier diving horse was going up for auction. And there was another diving horse, and he had already been auctioned off and wound up in a slaughterhouse. And she didn't want it to happen to that horse. Now, as it happened, I was in Atlantic City exactly one time in my life at that point. And it was when I was 11 years old. My father worked for the Attorney General of New Jersey. So he had to go to the Democratic National Convention. So he took my mother and me along for the ride. And part of what we did was go to the steel pier. My mother and I, my father was working. My mother and I went to the steel pier, and at the very far end of the pier, there was an act called Carver's High Diving Horses. And I knew nothing about the history of the act, who Carver was. I knew nothing, but the image of that horse stuck with me forever. And I didn't even know why. I certainly didn't know at the time, but as the years went by, every now and then I would think about them. So now this woman calls and says the horse is in danger of slaughter. I kind of went crazy and I said, no, we'll handle it. Don't worry about it. And I, Cleveland called, ship to shore. They had that. This sounds like the Middle Ages. But I told him about it and he said, oh, no problem. We'll get the horse. And so after he got back, he gave me the blank check. I went to the auction and I bought him. And as I said in the book, and so our courtship began, because there was an element of that to it, that I wanted him to like me. He didn't trust me. I tried this. I tried that. He was a little bit rough around the edges. He was sort of like an old carny type, you know. If he could have had a stogie in the corner of his mouth, he probably would have. But I was just, you know, I just wanted him to like me. And I had to prove my worth to him. And eventually I did. And so we had a fantastic relationship. And then in the course of it, I was working for the Fund for Animals. At that time, they were involved in airlifting burros, which are the same as donkeys, airlifting them from the Grand Canyon because the Park Service was going to shoot them all. They said, that's the only way you can solve this problem. And Cleveland said, I don't think so. So he got a judge to issue an injunction, and they got all the burros out of the Grand Canyon. Well, once they got them out, they took them to their ranch in Texas, but they couldn't stay there because then there were more. There were some from Death Valley and some from Bandelier National Monument. And then there were the Mustangs. Well, they had to find homes. Once again, he started sending me 40 burros at a time because that's what the truck would hold. And then from there on, I would, you know, I was feeling my way in the dark. But it worked out for the most part. For the most part, it worked out. So that's why I had a history, a weird history of finding homes for odd animals.
Yeah, yeah. How much did you pay at auction for Gamal?
$2,600.
That was a good bit of money in those days,
too. It was a lot of money. He was, I think, worth about $500.
And there was some media attention at the auction as well, as I recall, wasn't there?
There was. That was a surprise to me. I mean, people in this part of the world knew about the diving horses. Everybody knew. They started on the Steel Pier in 1930. And everybody who went to Atlantic City, they always saw the diving horses. But even if you'd never been to Atlantic City, you'd heard of them. But I didn't think it was going to stir that much attention, and it did. I mean, there we go again. There were flash bulbs in the cameras, and you know, the local Philadelphia stations were there and sticking a microphone in my face and misquoting me to beat the band.
Yes. Well, you know, I didn't know much about. I knew there were diving horses. I didn't know much of the details of it. For the listeners. This was a horse leaping from a platform into water with a rider on its back. Is that?
Yes. They would run up a ramp, get to the top. The woman would leap on and hold on to a flimsy little harness. It was almost like a belt, a leather belt. And sometimes the horse would jump right off. And other times they would look around, not because they were afraid, but, you know, it was just, well, I'm not in any hurry. They'd look at the ocean. They'd look at the crowd. Sometimes the trainer of the horses would get them to do things like, are you ready to go yet? And the horse would either put its head up and down or back and forth for yes or no. You know, so there was a little shtick going on there. And then eventually the horse would dive.
And I didn't know this. I would have thought they would have had to been, you know, basically forced into it. But it sounds like from what you described that they kind of went up that ramp the way a greyhound goes into the starting box. They were ready to go.
Yes. And the ones who were professional diving horses wanted to do it. Not all the ones who tried out not all of the horses that the owners tried out for the job wanted to do it. And they would start just with getting their feet wet and then a little kiddie pool, getting them to stand in it. And then what about jumping a foot? And there would be somebody on their back. Let's go over a, you know, 1 foot jump, and then higher and higher. And some would say, eh, that's enough. And others, yeah, okay, let's see. But it's like people. And I wouldn't jump off of that platform for any amount of money. And those women who did it said that was the most fun they ever had in their life.
Go figure. It's, yeah. I mean, it's just amazing. It's like the Greyhounds. It's another parallel. They're natural athletes. And once they get that in their blood, they enjoy doing it and they do it. And, that, you know, certainly a horse like Gamal deserved a retirement rather than being sold at auction. But on the other hand, thank goodness you were there. It had a huge impact on your life, and you came to know about horses. And so what I particularly enjoyed the part, the chapter in the book where you first went to the boarding farm and had to learn all the various terms. I bought my first horse in 96, and I had the same experience. Luckily, kind horse girls took pity on me and taught me all the terms and so forth, and, you know, the basics of horse care. So I particularly enjoyed reading that chapter of the book about where you kind of got broken into the equine community.
It's another language and it's another community.
How long did you have with Gamal?
9 years.
Oh, that's great.
9 years and a couple of months.
Yeah. Yeah. And all the different adventures you had with him, where you would take him to a different place. And the first time he jumped into a creek and, you know, loved being back in the water. That was a great description as well.
The house I owned at the time had a meadow and there was a creek that ran through it. And as soon as he saw that water, he made a beeline for it. But then other times later, we went into the Delaware River and I thought he was just going to, you know, kick the dirt and water around on the edge. But he wanted to go. And then I thought, oh my God, we're both going to die. And so that was a kind of a turning point, you know, where I thought, I can't let this happen. And I jumped on him, you know, jerked his head around and demanded that we go back on shore or we would have died. I'm sure we would have died. And he must have known I meant business. And that was the first time that he ever did what I asked of him. And when that day, that first time when we walked back to the barn, the lead rope was slack. You know, he just was letting me take him wherever I wanted to.
Yeah.
I proved myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the basics of the new book. When's it coming out? Where is it available? Kindle version, all that. Tell us about that.
It comes out on September 28th. It's in Kindle, I guess. Yes, a Kindle version. Is that an ebook? Is that the same
thing? Yeah, that's an ebook. Same thing.
Okay.
My copy was sent to me as a Kindle book, so I can attest to that.
And hardcover and an audio book. And they asked me to narrate the book. That was such a thrill.
have you finished that or is that ongoing?
No, I just finished it last week. It took about a week.
Your voice held up okay?
It did. Yeah, like I had breaks, drank a little water, went back in. It was, I never expected to do anything like that in my life, but I did it. So yes, it's coming out and I hope it'll sell well. I have a lot of vet bills to pay. I'm telling you, I have vet bills. Oh my God.
Well, I can see lots of parallels, not just the horse lover, greyhound lover thing, but the autobiographical aspect of it's very interesting. It's funny in parts. You tell these stories about these guys in Texas, the honcho, the head honcho guy.
And watermelon, right?
Yes, yes. Mm. It's a well-written, easy-to-read, page-turning type of book. And I think everybody that's been involved in greyhound adoption should enjoy reading it and enjoying the parallels between, horse and burrow rehoming and greyhound rehoming. So
I don't think of it as a horse book, even though that might sound strange because of the title, but it's an animal book, and certainly the greyhounds play a part, but I would say it's the prequel to my work with greyhounds.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you going to do a book tour?
It's going to be almost completely virtual.
Ah. And maybe you can give us some links and we'll put that in the show notes for where you'll be appearing and so forth. And we can have folks have a look at it.
When is this going to air?
This will go in about 2 weeks, something like that. I think we kind of determine as soon as
they have they have me doing a lot of interviews in September before the book comes out, but
yeah.
I can certainly keep you apprised of what else is going on.
Yeah, that'd be great. We'll definitely want to let folks know about it. I see a movie out of it myself.
Do you?
Who do you think should star as you?
I don't know any movie stars anymore. I really don't. But it would be harder to cast Gamal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I guess you would have to have a horse dive. Although they did make a movie called A Girl and Her Five Brave Horses, something like that. They made that into Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken.
Uh huh.
And it's supposed to be the true story. It's complete fiction. But I think they did the digital. The way they do it, where there wasn't really a horse diving.
Yeah, yeah. CG. So yeah, yeah.
Computer generated.
Right? Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, maybe some enterprising film producer will pick up on it, because it's exactly the kind of movie I like, the little known stories that are, you know, aren't really recorded in history very well. And then somebody picks it up and thinks, this is a great story. This would make a great movie. And so let's hope that happens.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
More money for the vet bills.
Yes. The vets are rubbing their hands together as they're listening.
Well, Cynthia, it's been a great time having you. I'm glad we could get you out here on the Greyhound Nation. And good luck with the book and continued good work in greyhound adoption.
Thank you very much. I really appreciated this interview. It was a lot of fun.
And listeners, we'll see you on the next episode of the Greyhound Nation.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. You can follow Greyhound Nation wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, leave us a comment on Facebook or post a review on your favorite podcast app. We love to hear from our listeners, so visit our website at greyhoundnation.dog and you can fill out our contact form. That's greyhoundnation.dog. If you do want to follow us on Facebook, also Twitter and Instagram, just search for Grey Nation Show. This episode was produced in collaboration with host John Parker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dimitri Taras. Thanks to our guest this episode, Cynthia Branigan. Cynthia's new book, The Last Diving Horse in America, will be released in October 2021. It's available for pre-order now on Amazon.com. The third edition of her other book, Adopting the Racing Greyhound, is also available on Amazon.com. I'm Michael Burns, and you've been listening to Greyhound Nation.